European leaders attend an emergency summit. The European Central Bank cuts interest rates.
And what it all means for us.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Thursday, December 8th.
Welcome. Coming up, we take an attitude check of the economy.
John Corzine goes to Capitol Hill to answer for MF Global's collapse.
And why all of retail is keeping an eye on Costco.
All that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The European Central Bank took action this morning, cutting Eurozone interest rates down to 1%. Here to explain how that could help the European economy is Adolfo Laurenti, Deputy Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial. Good morning, Adolfo.
Good morning.
Adolfo, let's start with the rate cut. How will cutting interest rates help the European economy grow?
Well, that's the major concern. They really need to do something not just for the economy, but for their banking system. Together with a cut in interest rate, the European Central Bank decided to extend the longer loans to the European banks and to accept a wider variety of collateral. All of this is made to make sure that there will be no credit crunch and some support will be provided to the economies that are already slowing. Because of austerity measure, we are seeing a likely recession in Italy. Belgium has a negative GDP reading the other day. So the European Central Bank is really trying to do something hard in order to help these economies.
It did announce a lot of actions, but the European Central Bank also hinted that it wasn't going to do anything drastic, like the massive bond buying program we did here. Is that a mistake?
Well, there is a huge controversy in Europe about the role of the European Central Bank in terms of helping the sovereign debt. That's the key issue tomorrow when the meeting will be convened in order to discuss greater fiscal integration. The understanding is that the preference by the Germans is to keep the European Central Bank out of the sovereign debt situation, but clearly the economies over there need to be more. The Germans are not really willing to go either in the direction of quantitative easing as the United States did. So the available tools to the ECB are not really that many. They are trying hard to do with what they are left.
Adolfo Laurenti with Mesirow Financial, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
European leaders are gathering today in Brussels to help save the euro and the European Union. It is their eighth such meeting, and this time there's a new plan from France and Germany that will likely serve as starting point. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from Brussels, there's been a lot of grumbling about Germany's role.
The plan calls for a new European treaty. It would spell out strict limits on the budgets of the 17 countries that use the euro. Any country that broke the rules would suffer automatic penalties. The plan is more German than French. For the first time in 60 years, Germany is the clear leader of Europe. That's provoked some complaint here about German dominance. But Alexander Grass-Lambsdorff, a German member of the European Parliament, says this is grossly unfair and will be all too familiar to Americans.
The world clamours for American leadership. When leadership is exercised, the world complains about bullying by the Americans. It's a little bit like this with Germany inside the European Union.
And it was not that long ago that Germany was accused of dithering over the debt crisis. But Germany in the driver's seat remains a tricky issue. One correspondent to a British newspaper wrote, "The Second World War has just ended and Germany has won." In Brussels, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Of course, Steve, we've heard a lot about the European Union's bailout fund to help its countries that are mired in debt. Well, the bailout fund is likely to need a bailout of its own from the International Monetary Fund. The IMF was set up during World War II to help stabilize the global financial system. And a lot of its money comes from, guess where?
The United States.
Comes from us. And that's got some people in Congress worried that American taxpayer money is at risk. John Dimsdale has that story.
The U.S. is historically the biggest contributor to the IMF, with a share of about $65 billion. In 2009, reacting to international financial turmoil, the U.S. contributed $107 billion more. Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers is sponsoring legislation to withdraw that extra credit line so taxpayers aren't on the hook.
We're also broke. So we're borrowing money from China, in essence, to help bail out the European Union countries.
If the IMF lends to European countries, could they default? Ted Truman at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says no contributor to the IMF has ever lost money.
The International Monetary Fund is a preferred creditor in the whole international financial system, so that means it always gets paid first. So the level of risk is essentially zero.
Truman says a pullback of U.S. support for the IMF would cause a collapse of the international financial system. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A lot of European countries are in trouble economically because of the ratings on their debt. Greek debt that used to be rated AAA is now rated junk. And banks use those ratings to decide how much risk they want to take.
Well, now federal regulators are proposing those ratings should lose a lot of their clout. Marketplace's Gregory Warner is with us now to talk about that story. Hey, Gregory.
Hey there.
So talk about this new rule being proposed.
Well, this takes us back to the years before the financial crisis, when rating agencies gave these AAA ratings to bets we know now were risky, like mortgage-backed securities or Greek debt. And then these ratings meant that banks didn't have to put up any cash or hardly any cash of their own. And then when things went south and they didn't have money to cover their losses, we had to bail them out. So I called Karen Petru, a banking analyst at Federal Financial Analytics. She says regulators are now telling banks they have to use public data, not raters' opinions.
To cut that cord, to stop unquestioned reliance on the rating agencies, we want the banks to have enough shareholder equity backing their bets so that they're betting with their money, not just ours.
So, Gregory, then after all of these financial crises, does this mean we're downgrading the ratings agencies?
Well, the problem has always been, okay, we know rating agencies don't work that well, but what do you replace them with? Who's going to provide that third-party objectivity? Mm-hmm. So the U.S. solution unveiled yesterday is to introduce these fairly complex algorithms, tables and formulas. Europe's solution is different. They've proposed coming up with a government agency to rate bonds.
All right. Marketplace's Gregory Warner. Thanks.
Thanks.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Today, John Corzine goes back to Congress. This time, instead of asking the questions, he'll be answering for the collapse of brokerage firm MF Global. Corzine was the CEO of the company and is accused of taking huge risks on European bonds. The company also can't find hundreds of millions of dollars. Ever lose that much money, Steve?
You know what? I was just thinking, what did I do with those hundreds of millions of dollars? I think it's in my change purse. Well, I don't have a change purse, but the little compartment in my car.
Unbelievably, that's actually what happened at MF Global. Corzine has submitted testimony to Congress saying he doesn't know where that money is, and Heidi Moore has that story for us.
For most of his career, John Corzine took the kinds of risks that paid off big. He made his name trading government bonds at Goldman Sachs, became the firm's CEO, and then wrestled the secretive bank into going public. Roy Smith was a partner at Goldman and saw Corzine in action.
Well, he took large risks when he was at Goldman Sachs, without any question.
Corzine left Wall Street to be a U.S. senator and a one-term governor of New Jersey. Then last year, he joined MF Global, a small commodities brokerage. As CEO, he pushed it to take big risks on European bonds with its own money. Goldman might have been able to absorb those losses, but MF wasn't. Corzine's lucky streak ended.
I was concerned that, you know, he was walking into a firm that had no experience, really, of dealing in the kind of risk-taking that he wanted them to take.
And it was likely Corzine was a little rusty.
He'd been out of the game for about 10 years, and this is a very difficult game to leave for such a long time. Very hard to just go away for 10 years and come back and assume everything is the same.
The biggest issue in MF Global's collapse is over $1 billion of lost customer money. It shouldn't have been betting with that. Gerald Salenti was an MF Global client who's hunting for his lost cash. he thinks Corzine got a pass because of his reputation.
If any broker did what John Corzine allegedly did, boy, those SWAT teams would be there, you know, and they'd be breaking down the doors and arresting him, but not John Corzine.
Corzine's fall from grace is like a Shakespearean tragedy, says Paul Argenti, a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
You know, just hearing about what he was like when he was at Goldman Sachs versus what we see now, it's kind of scary.
Corzine's former colleagues know they'll face backlash if they go easy on him today. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Wholesale club Costco said today its profit rose slightly, helped in part by higher gasoline sales and currency exchange rates. But you know, Costco and a few other stores have done better in this sour economy, Stacey, because of all the things they sell. And, you know, they sell a lot of things,
yeah.
Right? All kinds of household
items. A lot of things.
Even some groceries. a lot of things in massive bulk, right? Well, it sounds like
yes.
A simple formula. Other stores are taking notice, as reporter Sally Herships explains.
If you really want to understand the U.S. retail industry, there are three stores whose aisles you should browse.
Walmart, obviously.
Along with Amazon and Costco. This, according to Jeff Weidauer at Vestcom International. It's a marketing company for the retail industry. Weidauer says Costco's 596 stores are a great indicator of where lots of different products are likely to see growth.
They're buying milk, they're buying eggs, they're buying diamond rings.
Barry Berman teaches business at Hofstra University. Berman says smart retailers try to emulate Costco.
It's a firm, you know, you want to look at and see what they're doing and see what they're doing right.
One strategy from the superstore, opportunistic buying, looking for goods at the lowest possible price.
They only want a 17% profit margin because they want you coming back.
But other stores want your business too, which is why they may be looking carefully at Costco today. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, maybe it's our gloomy economy, but it's a tall world after all these days.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
And by that, I mean a tall half-calf cappuccino
world. Oh, that sounds so good right now.
I know, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The world is drinking more coffee. The whole world. From London, the BBC's Matthew Davis has more.
Coffee consumption has grown by an average of 2.5% over the last 10 years and is still surging ahead, despite the fact that many drinkers around the world have less money in their pockets. But it's not that we're drinking more coffee because we're working harder and need the extra energy. According to Jose Setti, the head of operations at the London-based International Coffee Organization, it's that new consumers are being turned on to the bean.
Even when times are hard, people still drink coffee. And the growth in coffee consumption these days occurs much more in emerging markets, which are bearing up much better under this economic turbulence than in the developed world.
Over the next 5 years, raw coffee prices are expected to fall, and that'll bring in even more drinkers. Last year, the world consumed more than 8 million metric tons of coffee. That's 2.4% more than the previous year, and enough to fill more than 80 aircraft carriers. In London, I'm the BBC's Matthew Davis for Marketplace.
Well, there's more coffee bean consumed, and in Norway, more butter.
Really?
Yes, a little segue there. And now Norway is suffering from a butter shortage. Can you guess why, Steve? This is pretty great.
Not enough cows.
Atkins diet.
Yeah,
seriously.
Really?
There's a big low-carb diet fad that swept the country. It's also been a low-production year for butter.
Wow.
But butter now costs $20 a pound in Norway.
$20 a pound?
$20 a pound.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're packaging it and selling it as a holiday gift this year.
Wow.
So you know what this means, Steve.
Someone's going to get churned. No.
Oh, that's pretty good.
I'm sorry.
I've got another one, though. Norwegian kids everywhere could actually say, I can't believe it's not butter on Christmas morning.
I can't believe it's not butter. It'll be in a tub and not in a stick.
Or I can't believe it's butter.
The number of people filing for first-time unemployment benefits was down last week. The Labor Department says that number dropped by 23,000 to the lowest level since February, which is a pretty big improvement in a job market that appeared to be stuck in neutral. So is the country doing better economically these days, or are the good days all in the past? Today we launch a weekly conversation called the Marketplace Attitude Check, a new partnership we're doing with the polling firm Gallup. And Frank Newport is Gallup's editor-in-chief. He's with us now. Hey, Frank.
Good morning.
Do Americans still believe in the American dream? Is income mobility as possible as before?
You know, that's a fascinating question, and I think the data show us it depends on the time frame. If you ask Americans right now, how are things in America, and do you have a good opportunity to get ahead, the answers are more negative. Only 8% right now say now is a good time to find a quality job, and that's the lowest in our Gallup poll history of asking that question. However, this is the big however, we do have some questions where we ask Americans, you know, let's think about the future facing your family and how satisfied are you in general with how things are going. And those are fairly positive. So I think if you focus Americans long term, they still do believe in the future. But if you focus them on the short term, they're reacting to the current economic conditions and they're very negative.
You think it's because Americans always feel like things were better years ago? I mean, that there was this idyllic time, like, you know, 50 years ago, where things were just grand?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, that's an interesting question. We do have a way of asking Americans, you know, how are things compared to what it was like for your parents when they were your age? And actually, we haven't seen much of a drop in that, and that's still positive. Americans, the majority of Americans still say, hey, we're better off than our parents were, and they still say that now, and they told us that decades ago when we first asked that question. You know, we have a question here, which is, rate the future facing you and your family, and we first asked that in the summer of 1963, when John Kennedy was still president. Fast forward to today, we just re-asked that same question again, and lo and behold, the answer is about 64% say they're satisfied with the future facing their family. That's what they told us when Kennedy was president, and that's what they're telling us today. So after these many years, we're really not seeing much change in terms of at least that measure.
Interesting stuff. Frank Newport, Gallup's editor-in-chief. Frank, thanks.
You bet.
Holiday shopping means great bargains on everything from big screen TVs to the hottest pair of sneakers.
Yeah.
It means malls and stores filled with all kinds of festive decorations,
that's
of course.
Nice, yes.
I know, it is. And, of course, for many people, it also means long lines.
Oh, yes, it does.
Well, for a lot of retailers this season, they are taking steps to streamline the dreaded checkout process.
Ray Smith wrote a piece in today's Wall Street Journal about how stores are trying to make holiday shopping less of a pain. And we're talking to Ray in today's Midday Extra. Hey, Ray.
Hi.
Thanks for doing this. What are some of the biggest reasons lines are so slow at store? I mean, is it just the sheer number of people?
It's that, but it's also some of the issues that people have in lines, whether it be they need a price check or they're paying with a check or they need to try another credit card. We've heard that before sometimes. Or simply someone who has a lot of things in their carts and may be in the line sort of deciding whether they want that or I don't want that, or can you tell me what the discount price is on that? Or so there's a combination of, you know, just little personal things, idiosyncrasies that can halt a line.
Or as I like to call them, complications.
Complications. And also, it can even be the cashier. I mean, I don't know if you've encountered, I know I've encountered
yes.
the chatty cashier.
I know exactly, yeah.
You know, who, it's more than small talk. It's like a conversation, and that can slow up a line. So it's all these little, like you said, complications that can come up.
So, Ray, you have to tell us now what steps the stores are taking to improve these issues and whether or not they're working.
Sure. Well, one of the things that you probably be noticing more and more is inspired by Apple stores with the use of sort of the mobile devices to check you out so you don't even have to wait in line.
Oh, yeah.
So some stores are doing that. Like beyond Apple, there's Nordstrom is doing that.
Well, you can swipe it, right? You can swipe it right there on the device.
Exactly.
Yeah, they have the portable cash registers.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing, though, that some stores are doing, having, like, assigning people, and you may have noticed this, like, in some grocery stores, like Trader Joe's or Whole Foods or even Starbucks, they have, like, what people call either line managers or line busters.
They have those at the Trader Joe's here in New York.
Exactly. And And I, you know, it's not proven to show that actually speeds up the line, but it does. But there's research that shows that it does reduce stress. That people feel like when they see somebody who is quote unquote managing a line or moving the line forward, it does help to reduce stress. Even if the line isn't moving faster, there's just a sense of somebody's in control.
Sounds like you've got a line going over there, Ray. What's are you in the middle of FAO Schwartz?
No, just in the newsroom, that's all. But just the perception that somebody is making sure that, A, nobody's skipping, nobody's getting ahead, and that somebody's in control sort of helps. So, but Home Depot, for instance, has gone a bit further. Instead of that line manager just serving a purpose that's sort of symbolic, the line manager actually pre-scans you while you're in line. Pre-scanning meaning actually scanning your items so that you take a receipt to the cashier when you get to the register.
Is this something new, Ray? I mean, are we talking about retailers who have finally come to the conclusion that people don't like to stand in line?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you say that, because you would think that this is like a no-brainer, but it is something that, especially with the growing competition from online retailers, you know, this holiday season has been the biggest ever for online shopping. So this is a realer threat than it has been for brick and mortar retailers in the past. So yeah. I think they're taking it more seriously now that consumers don't have to wait in line. Whereas before they might have felt that they had to wait, they wouldn't get their Christmas gift in time for that person. Now they can say, you know what, I'm not going to wait on this line. I'm just going to go online and get it. So they have to now focus on customer service in general, and lines is a big part of that. They won't say this, but it's partly because they're feeling the threats from online retailing.
So, Ray, if you wouldn't mind giving us some tips on how we can be efficient with our holiday shopping, where and how should we be shopping to avoid the horrible lines that can happen around the holidays?
Don't chat with a cashier. For goodness sakes, you don't have to tell the story.
Don't tell them your astrological sign under any circumstances.
It's not necessary.
Exactly. You just go there with a frown to make it clear that you're impersonal and you're
fight face.
I don't want to talk to you today. Jeez.
But one of the things that people often make the mistake of doing is just counting, looking at the number of people online and trying to figure out whether that line will move fast or not. But the actual factors that matter more than the actual number of people in line is really looking at what they have in their cards. And also, if you have the time, monitoring how fast the cashier is. The line could be short because people have figured out that the line is moving really slowly.
They've left in despair.
And also look at just, you know, is the cashier chatty? Is the cashier taking a really long time? We've all seen this, the cashier who bags really slowly. I mean, they're probably being really careful. You know, they want to make sure you're not walking out and your bag is spilling over. But on the other hand, are they taking a really long time? Are they being too careful? So it's things like that seem obvious, but people don't take that into account. They just count the number of people in line.
See, I look at the customers, Ray. I look at the customers, and I'm like, that lady's going to write a check. I can tell. And this guy over here is going to be a problem.
That's another. Yeah, I mean, you know, I know it seems like that stereotyping, but you do have to sort of also take that into account. You really have to do a little bit of judging, if you will, on who's gonna you know, be a problem at the register. But you know, I talked with a bunch of people who prefer to choose, you know, they prefer to choose their own line rather than having the single line format, even though the single line format is faster. But retailers either don't like the single line format because it takes up a lot of space, or because it sort of prevents you from seeing sort of impulse items, if you will, while you're online. Because if you're in multiple checkout lines, that's more opportunities to upsell you with inexpensive. You've seen this at the grocery store where they put those tempting impulse items in the line, and some clothing stores are even trying to do that as well, some last-minute things that you might want to purchase that you didn't consider before, that you didn't even think you needed. So that's another way that retailers are trying to engage you while you're in line.
Reporter Ray Smith from the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
Thank you.
And happy line waiting.
Thank you.
And finally this morning, Ray and Stacy, to all those bosses out there who are bending over backwards to put a holiday party together, the latest poll commissioned by the job listing firm Glassdoor says don't bother. Forget about it.
That's terrible
advice. Well, here's why. Here is why. By wide margin, Stacey, a majority of workers surveyed said they'd rather have a cash bonus or a pay raise rather than a Christmas party. Other things employees chose instead include gift cards, company stock, a gym membership, a better health care plan. Yeah, I would think that people would want that over a Christmas party. The ability to work from home. Guilty. I would love that over a Christmas party. But you see, I do like the holiday party, and you've been to a couple of several marketplace holiday parties.
I have been to several, yes.
And you know, the best part about those parties, Stacey, is of course watching our coworkers karaoke to Lady Gaga after a few glasses of eggnog.
I know, it's amazing the high notes that Kai can hit. It really is.
Absolutely. I love it, absolutely. And it's something to look forward to every year. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.